You're listening to the Heavenly Chi podcast, episode number 87. Today, we're joined by Dr. Holly Carruthers, Chinese medicine practitioner and owner of Element Health in Denmark, Western Australia. Holly has been working with children and families for over 17 years, with a particular focus in pediatric Chinese medicine over the last 6 to 7 years. She's passionate about helping children thrive and believes that the changes we can make in a child's health today can have a profound impact on the rest of their lives. This year, Holly will be presenting at ACMAC with her workshop, Chinese Medicine for Children, A Place to Start in Clinic, with the goal of encouraging more practitioners to confidently work with children and families. In today's conversation, we'll be exploring why pediatrics remains an underutilized area of Chinese medicine, what skills practitioners need to work effectively with children, and why Holly believes this can be some of the most rewarding work we do. Holly, welcome to Heavenly Chi.
Thank you so much for having me, Jack and Claire. I'm very excited to be sharing the passion of pediatrics.
We can't wait to hear all about it. Is there anything in particular you'd like to start us off with? Is there anything that's front of mind for you with pediatrics? Why is this the topic that is so close to your heart, and what has brought it into the center of your practice?
So I would say the way that I got into pediatrics was out of pure terror. I remember working in my first clinic and a child booking in. And thankfully, there was another more experienced practitioner at that clinic at the time. And so I could refer the patient on to the more experienced practitioner and simply observe. So I like to think that, fear is the greatest motivator sometimes, and the outcome has been extremely positive for me. So as soon as a pediatric course became available at this time, I think it was 2011, Helen Gordon ran a three-part series in Melbourne and Sydney on practical pediatrics. So I jumped on that train, and she was such a clear presenter and just gave a step-by-step process so that when I came back to my practice, I had somewhere to start. And at that time, I guess I just was trying to find a bit more of a focus point based around women and gynecology and pediatrics, as well as psycho-emotional disorders. And so the next course that became available was one in Bali, where we got to run an afternoon clinic for women and children. So this was with Soma Devi or Soma Glick, and in the morning she would give us the lecture and the demonstrations and give us the skills to then take into the afternoon clinic to practice. And I came back from that Balinese clinic just wanting to adopt like 20 Balinese babies, and I knew probably at that time the joy and the love between patient and practitioner of just care. I think that was the hook for me.
I love that. That's such an inspiring way to get into a field, I think. Just having the fear and the terror of treating a patient motivate you so strongly to like literally travel to another part of the world to do mm-hmm. the kind of training you would need to really like immerse yourself in it and grasp it in a way that lets you give them the kind of care that you know that you can give them and that they deserve and that they're there to see you for.
Yes, and in a clinic or in a location like Bali, it really tests the skills of the practitioner because it's us or nothing else. And so there were times where it felt really important to be getting our diagnosis and treatment right, because for some of those children it was the matter of life and death. And so if Soma could identify a patient that is on that cusp, knowing their background or what they would be going home to, maybe a lack of nutrition or maybe extreme exposure to the environment and the elements, she would step in and we would observe her of how to how to support that patient. And she used Chinese herbs at that time, a little bit of homeopathy, and then our Shoni Shin and acupuncture, moxibustion, those practical skills. So that was the first time I had seen Shoni Shin, and that was a method of more the kind of Chinese medicine version of Shoni Shin. And once I saw that, I had heard that, well, I bought the book of Thomas Wernick's Shoni Shin, which is more Japanese style. And I know you two are probably excellent readers. I'm a very practical face-to-face learner. And so when I read that book, honestly, it was so hard for me to read. I just waited until he came to, I think it was Melbourne first at the Shiatsu College. And his system changed my practice. As soon as I'd learnt this child's kind of development and stage of life that they're in, that the treatment changes based on their age. So, for example, are they a baby, a toddler, the start of school age, or finally more of an adult flow of our meridians? I then had a really clear pathway of where to take their body and what their system needs at that point in their life. So that's been revolutionary for me, and that's something I'd really like to start teaching, is that version of Shoni Shin in and around Australia.
And so, Holly, you mentioned that there's obviously a very different way of approaching the treatment of infants and toddlers and children in comparison to adults. Do you think that's where the fear and terror comes from? Because I'm sure that many of our listeners can identify and relate to that idea of feeling fearful or even pure terror at the idea of treating a baby, for example. Like, mm-hmm. Where do you think that comes from?
Do you mean the fear?
The fear and the terror. Like, why mm-hmm. is that such a mm-hmm. common sentiment with regards to the treatment of pediatrics?
Maybe because we know how delicate children are. And because children are so delicate, the input only needs to be so minimal for the outcome of excellent therapeutic results. So, you know, one of the questions I like to ask myself is pediatrics as simple as people say it is? And I think yes. Yes, because as you palpate a small baby's body, if you feel a hard, distended belly, you know you need to help them poop. And so that's as simple as maybe doing some tapping around their umbilicus or some tapping on their large intestine reflex zone on the lower back. You can be showing the parents how to do some very gentle abdominal massage. And then everyone knows stomach 36, right? That's going to descend the chi of the stomach and move that on, or even gallbladder 34. So I would say that one of the key skills a practitioner needs when working with children is excellent palpation and observation techniques, because you'll feel what's hot, you'll feel what's cold, you'll know where they're blocked. And all you need to do is just gently move that blockage on, and then the chi moves. It's like if you think of an adult as a big, messy ball of tangled wool that's in the sewing craft room and everything's a mess, and you're like, okay, I'll pull the red thread first and then I'll take the yellow thread. Whereas with a child, you just take one and woof, everything falls into place.
I love that analogy. It's it sounds so simple.
It is. I promise it is. I will say on 90% of cases, it's that simple.
What about the other 10%? What do you see there, and what makes it more complicated?
Just complexity of a health condition. So the two or three patients that I'm holding in my mind, the ones that I wake up in the morning thinking about or go to bed thinking about. Everyone has those patients. These are the ones that I think I have surrendered to. Well, these are just patients that need ongoing care for their life. So I had a very complex epileptic patient. He was 9. He had ADHD diagnosis, autism diagnosis, as well as this epilepsy that had come in. And I think I'm going to put asthma in there as well for this particular patient. So there was a lot going on. And so in that particular case, I could get him to the part where he used to have 20 seizures in a cluster, that got down to 3 or 4. So I was pretty happy with that in terms of the body was much less taxed. He wasn't falling in a heap for the week after and having to recover for as long. But he was still someone that needed ongoing care. And then the other one is when we think of a kidney Jing deficiency. I had another little boy who was quite developmentally slow in cognition, reading, writing. Physically, he was on par, maybe even better than his peers, but to put this child in a school classroom was going to be very difficult. So he went into a more specialised school for children with special needs, but he was the child that would need ongoing care. His muscles were very soft and spongy. He had very flaccid ears. He needed a lot of help. And sometimes the family can't continue to come every week or every fortnight like we know that child needs. And maybe, you know, maybe in the future we would be under different NDIS programs or something so that we can be more easily accessible for these families.
I love that. I think that's a really, those are really powerful examples. Thank you for sharing some of that. It makes, I think I find it really fascinating being a relatively fresh practitioner because you hear about a lot of those things like the flaccid ears and the spongy muscles and the Jing depletion that's evident quite early on in textbooks. And I'm not very good at reading textbooks either, for the record. They tend to put me to sleep quite quickly. But it's really fascinating to hear some of those real life examples, especially when it's so evident in kids, I think. Because like you said, adults, we tend to be like a bit of a tangled ball of wool of different layers of things and problems and patterns that we've accumulated over the course of our lives, which is what we know from our theories. But it must be quite fascinating, I imagine, to see that right at the beginning, which is also, it sounds really powerful. And I know that you mentioned that one of the things that you've mentioned was that there's such a profound impact that we can have on the course of a person's life when we see them at this such an early stage, where you can correct some of those imbalances before they embed deeply enough to have that lasting impact and become those imprinted patterns. Can you expand on that a little bit? And what is it about this that you think is such a powerful opportunity for us in our profession?
Well, yes, please. Jumping out of my seat in excitement for this one. Because can you imagine if the adult patient that you currently are seeing had the help of Chinese medicine in their developing years? You know, that changes everything. Even when I see a patient and I know that they're coming up to this pubescent age, I'm really encouraging them to come in for a decent course of treatments in the hope that I can eradicate whatever that suffering is before they go into puberty. The idea being that whatever the child has had from a young age, let's go with a lung weakness. And let's say that they were a baby soon after birth, they had eczema, which is, as we know, the lungs are expressed in the skin. And then when they started to go into daycare, they were catching every cough, cold, and snot that was going around. And all of a sudden, we're getting into lingering pathogen world where they've got lumpy, bumpy necks. They've got glue ear because of these old lingering infections. The body hasn't had the chi to push the last of those sicknesses out. It's parked it to deal with it later. Then we're in asthma territory. Now we've got maybe stuck old dry phlegm sitting in the chest. They've been taken to the GP. They've been put on a Ventolin. And we've got a complex heat and yin deficient dry phlegm state in the lungs. And I don't know about you guys, but down where I live at the moment, we've had whooping cough going around. And so imagine if this child has come into school and that's been going around. You know, that's risky for them. So whenever I see a patient, I'm making sure that first that initial sickness has been cleared from the body so that it starts afresh the next time. And then I'm also thinking, well, what key milestone are they coming into? Are they a baby and just about to walk and coming into toddlerhood? Because this is a really big shift. Or are they that 3 to 6 year old where they're having a huge leaps in development, both cognitive and physically? Or are they a little bit older and they're starting to go into puberty? That's the end of the line for me in some sense of I really want to make sure that those lingering pathogens are out of the body and that their lung system is so much more robust and strong, and ideally they're not carrying that asthma into adulthood. That's the goal.
That's very impressive, actually. I love that there's like a really clear pathway for you as well from start to finish. Do you stop working with kids after they enter puberty? Is that kind of where you do draw a bit of a line in the sand in terms of the age or developmental stage, if you like, of kids that you see? Or is that, do you keep seeing them ongoingly if that's something that they're interested in?
Good question. I keep seeing them until they're 18 or even a young adult. It's more in my practitioner private brain that I'm thinking I've got this sliding doors moment of if I can have cleared that childhood sickness before puberty, I've got a chance of making sure that they don't take that into adulthood. If I first see that child, the eczema, asthma child, and they're suddenly 15, I'm absolutely still treating them. I'm maybe just thinking that this might be a more ongoing situation, that maybe we get to the point where they still have asthma, but perhaps they only need Ventolin a few times rather than being completely cleared of asthma if they'd had all the treatment before reaching puberty.
So it sounds like the clinical outcomes you're expecting are quite different based on when you first start seeing a patient.
Exactly. The younger, the better. I think, you know, you work with a baby versus a 10-year-old. It comes back to what you originally mentioned and what we spoke about with that tangled ball of wool. You know, a small baby has had no infections, or if any, very few. And they haven't had a trip to Bali and got gastro, and they haven't had whatever's gone around the daycare or school. So it's just a cleaner slate, so to speak. And so you can expect more profound outcomes, especially in those little kids. You know, I can have a toddler walk up my stairs or be carried up my stairs because they're in an acute viral stage and they've got a fever and they're feeling really rotten. And then by the time we've had, you know, maybe of 10 minutes on their body, they're walking out, they're cooler, they're suddenly saying, "Mum, I'm hungry." They'll accept some water. And for me as a clinician, that is so rewarding. And I think that's what really hooked me into the pediatrics of, you know, with an adult when they go home and they say, "Oh, yeah, I'm feeling better." You're like, you know, was that my treatment? Was it the new diet they started? Was it because they, you know, broke up with that person that wasn't good for them? You know, with a child, it happens so quickly that there's no doubt that your treatment did that. For example, they're constipated, and by the time they're in the car, they've already pooped and made a mess. You know, it's certain that the treatment has caused that particular outcome. Or you'll clear phlegm, and in front of your eyes, no joke, I've had this in clinic, a toddler has had mucus pouring out of their tear ducts. Because my treatment principle was to clear phlegm, it's sitting in the head and the sinuses and the ears. You can vomit it up. There's a front door. Or it can actually come out your eyes. So this little babe just had mucus pouring out of his eyes. Oh, dear. And that's, you know, parent education. This is a good thing. It's okay. It will pass. They will be feeling much better once this mucus has cleared their system.
I love that, the profound and immediate changes that come with treatment. And it's, you know, especially the younger ones, like there's no filter. The three-year-old is going to say, "This is how I feel right now," you know, independent of any coaching that they might feel that has happened. You mentioned about the parents, you know, and how they respond. How do you find the dynamic of the parents? Because obviously when you're working with children, it's not just you and the child. You've got the parent dynamic as well to manage. How do you approach that?
So I would encourage everyone to have an intake form. An intake form gives the parent an opportunity to put down all of the history of the child. And then in an ideal world, and for me, I'd like to say I ring every single new patient, but practically that doesn't always work. But if I could, I would have a phone conversation with every parent before the child's initial consultation to have the parent be able to express their concerns, their worries, parts of the child's life that they might feel like is impacting them that maybe isn't child appropriate for their little ears. Because when they come in to the clinic and when they're in the waiting room, I'm focusing on the child. My goal is in that first appointment for that first set amount of time, whether that be 10, 20 or up to 30 minutes, I'm purely on building rapport mode. So I'll be making eye contact with the parent at different times, giving them a smile. Depending on the level of engagement from the child directs me as to how much attention I put to the parent. So, for example, I'll break this up into a deficient child and a more excess child. So at my clinic here, I have some stairs and I chose to work up the stairs thinking that every child that comes in is going to want to bowl up and climb up these stairs. That was a good choice in the end. But say the deficient child, I'll be preparing to go downstairs and I'm listening already. And with a more deficient child, they're probably going to be pretty quiet. They're going to be sitting on their parents' lap. When I come in and I'm quite a big personality, I'll be like, "Hi, I'm Dr. Holly. You must be Timmy." By the time I've done that, they're probably hiding. They're probably getting as far behind their parents' leg as possible. So at that point, I'm really dividing my attention or directing my attention to the parent to take the pressure off the kid. They need some time to suss me out. They need to know, is this person safe? Am I safe? And what's going to happen here? And so that parent will be getting a lot of attention versus the more excessive child. By the time I'm getting ready to walk down my stairs, I can hear them. They're probably not even sitting. They're running around and I'm going, God, I hope they're not barging in on other people's consults. They're the kids you don't want in your waiting room for very long. And so they're the ones I come up to. Hi, I'm Dr. Holly. You must be Timmy. And I put my hand out and they're the kids that will take it. They're like, oh, great, you know. And I'll say, oh, wow, you know, I'm so glad you've come. I hope you're good at climbing stairs because I work at the top of this castle. Like, are you good at climbing stairs? And then, you know, their chest is pumped and they're stomping their way up. And so the parent knows, all right, she's got this. The kid's got this. And I'm engaging more directly with the child and I'm just getting a, oh, hey, and you know what you said in the intake form about their such and such? I'll just get some clarity on things I need from the parent, but most of my attention would be on that child.
I love that. It sounds like it's you've got to tweak your skill set a little bit to make sure that you're engaging based on what the patient needs, but in a more complicated dynamic when you have a parent involved, I guess, which I personally imagine is one of the things that might instill some of that fear or terror, along with the fact that you're going to know immediately if what you're doing is working or not. When you are treating kids and families really too, I suppose, because like you said, I don't have children myself, so I don't know personally, but from what I've seen and what I've heard, what's going on for the child is going to have like a pretty profound impact on their parents and on the family dynamic. And if they're really sick or demanding a lot of attention or really, even really closed off and withdrawn and hard to engage with, even for the parents, perhaps that will, yeah, place a certain kind of burden on those dynamics at home as well. And so I guess you're having what's happening in my mind is as I'm listening to you talk about what you're doing and how you approach all of this is this like ripple effect that is happening through the family dynamic. It's not just the child you're working with and healing, you're healing the whole family in a lot of ways by the sounds of things.
That's right, Jack. Yes. On the first point you made about having to be adaptive and flexible based on what's coming in, you know, you can't meet each child like you would with adults where you generally show up as yourself. With a child, you have to be like an octopus. And I'm an ocean water swimmer and I've seen these octopus under the water, and as they creep across reef, they'll be brown, and then they go over seaweed and they're more red, and then all of a sudden they're hiding in some limestone and they're white. And that's called crypsis. And what crypsis means is to seamlessly blend into your environment to evade predators. And so these children are the predators. You have to stay on their good side. You have to make sure that you have so much rapport because you only get one chance with a child. They, if you hurt them or if you make them feel unsafe at any time, you've lost them. And fair enough. You know, I think that's fair enough. And then on your second point around heal the child to heal the family, having a trauma background, I always thought that, well, if they're still in an environment that is unsavory, that, well, you know, what can I do? How can I heal this child if the environment is still really, really difficult? And Rebecca Avon was the person who challenged me on this, and I'm so glad she did, because if you think of a family system as a five-element system, so let's say that this child, Matilda, is a watery child and they have issues with wetting the bed. And they're highly anxious. They're really scared and fearful. They have separation anxiety when they go to school, etc. And they might have overbearing parents. They might have an overbearing sibling. And the original practitioner me would think, oh, you know, I don't know if I can do much in this situation because, you know, they have a bit of a constitutional weakness and the energy coming from around them is far too dominant. But Rebecca talks about if you can strengthen that constitutional water element, if you can fill up their cup, so to speak, then they change everything. Because they rise, something else has to fall. So the overbearing sibling or the parent, they have no choice but to adjust to this new way of being that this your patient now is. And I've tried it in clinic and I would say it's absolutely true. And I'm so thrilled because it makes for a much more hopeful situation around treating complex families, around treating different deficiencies in families or this idea of a family web that by helping one also does help and benefit the rest. So that's pretty rewarding, you know, when you're not only affecting your one patient, but you're also healing families and you know, maybe, and I'm going to say maybe putting that out there of breaking those generational trauma patterns. You know, if you can get engaged with the child's constitution and makeup and benefit them and strengthen them so that they are living to their most full, abundant potential, I wonder if they would be as impacted by what's going on around them versus if they were untreated.
You can only imagine that that building, that tonifying, that nourishing that you're doing for these kids, it can't help but have that pretty profound, positive impact on their capacity to just be resilient to life, isn't it? Because I'm thinking of a couple of patients I've seen recently who, yeah, have had very hard lives objectively, but also haven't had the support clearly for a very long time that would have let them overcome those challenges. And I think it's one of the really cool things about kids is that you said you need to be an octopus, but that's kind of because they're a bit like octopuses too, I imagine, because they're really adaptable and they're, given the circumstances, they're very, very resilient. And personally, I think that the way that they respond so quickly to treatment is a really good example of that. All you need to do is correct the circumstances internally a little bit and bang, the mucus comes out of their eyeballs. It's just their body will just do what it is designed to do, just given the right encouragement and circumstances. I wonder, what impact do you think that this could have? Do you have a dream or a vision of what the future could be like for generations to come if we as a community of health practitioners embrace treating pediatrics in a more serious and more more engaged way?
Yeah, yes, please, is what I say to more practitioners treating children. You know, I think as a starting point, it would take the pressure off the Western medical healthcare system, which I don't know what it's like in Melbourne, but in Western Australia, if I've had children that really need to see a pediatrician, whether private or public, it's at least 6 months. And 6 months in childland may as well be 10 years in adult world. So even if we're the stopgap between now and when they seek that specialist care, there's so much that we can do. And I challenge, will they still need that appointment when we've had a few turns with them? And so if everyone opened their doors to children as much as they do adults, or fertility at the moment is massive, the schools would be a much nicer place to be. We would be able to hold excellent human beings as teachers, because unfortunately nowadays teachers are expected to be therapists and mom and dad, and you know, there's, and be teaching them and be behavioral managing and medicating. You know, this child is sent to school with a special care plan of the different medications they need, or the assisted learning programs. If we could take the pressure off those systems a bit, I think schools and teachers and everyone generally around children would be less stressed. And then, you know, when they're coming into adulthood, I feel like one of the great gifts that we have as Chinese medicine doctors is validating someone's true self. And I use Lillian Pearl Bridges' face reading. And so not only for the child, but also for the parent, if you can help identify this child's element, and it will shift and change and tweak as they grow. But say I get a 10-year-old coming in that has very pointed features, maybe they've got freckles, maybe they've got red hair or curly hair, and they're bouncing around my room, I'm thinking, okay, maybe this kid's a fire element kid. And so I might say to them, because remember, I'm directing my attention to the child as much as possible, saying, oh, you know, I wonder if, you know, you tend to like to do lots of different things, maybe not finish everything that you start. Maybe you're highly creative. Like, you know, what is, does this sound like you? And the parent's eyes are going, oh my goodness, you know. And I'm saying, you know, it's okay if you don't finish everything that you start. And it's okay that you want to jump from one thing to another, and that your brain is always on, and that maybe it's hard to sleep, because maybe that's just who you are, and we can support you in that. So you get to choose, how much do I want to liven up and use my fire element, or am I just going to let it simmer for a little bit?
It's interesting, you know, as you're talking about the way that you practice in clinic, and I'm trying to imagine all of the ways that it unfolds, and I think we've got a pretty good idea of how the initial interactions unfold, and you know, the importance of speaking to the parents before the child is even in the clinic, which I think is a really great piece of advice. And I'm wondering, what does it look like when the child's in the room with you, in your treatment room? You mentioned at the very start the distinction between Chinese Shonishin and Japanese Shonishin. Does that feature into this at all? Do you take inspiration from all different parts of Chinese medicine, or do you focus mainly on Shonishin? What does treatment room look like with Holly?
Okay, so I might break this into two parts in terms of physical treatment room, treatment space versus my practitioner skills in the treatment room. So firstly, the treatment room, like I said, we have the stairs coming up. I've got some lovely paintings, and I had this one behind me, which is essentially a search and find. So it's a forest theme. And I have kangaroos and wombats and blue wrens and frogs. And so the idea was, when they're on the treatment table, I can say, I wonder if you can see the kangaroos on my picture behind me. And they'll say, oh, yeah. And I'll say, and how many kangaroos are there? and they'll count them up. And so sometimes I'll be using that as a distraction if I'm needed, you know. And can you find the snake, the slithery, slimy snake? Where's the snake? And I'm touching somewhere that, you know, maybe they're sensitive. Maybe they're a bit ticklish around their neck. And so while I ask them about the snake and their eyes have gone over there for a minute, I can quickly check their lymph nodes or something like this. And then I also have a play. It's like a bookshelf. So I have a big background in Montessori education around how to set up the home and how to set up a classroom. And so this is a very specialized selection of toys that is few, not too many, that they can play with while I'm talking to the parent, or I'll be sitting down on the mat and playing with them, you know, trying to build this rapport piece. I also have a heat lamp, so it's particularly cold here in winter at the moment. So once they're up on the table, most kids do like to lay under the sun, we call it, and that either goes on the belly or the feet. If they're more liver chi stagnant, it's the feet. If it's more cold, weak middle jaw, it's the tummy. And then I have a hand basin because often I'll get snotted on, coughed on. I have to be washing my hands regularly. I'm washing the tools and the toys between each use. And so that's probably, oh, and I run a hospital grade air purifier in my environment. That would be another key, I think, when working with children. Because they will come to you very sick. You know, it's not like you can say, please don't come to me when you're sick, when you're treating children. And then from my end of the practical tools, I am really dedicated to the Thomas Wernick's Shoni Shin model because it is really child-centered and because it follows the phases of development for the child. As opposed to the Chinese one, which I will dip back to, say if they have a sore throat, I will use the little Shoni Shin rake tool and scrape, say, do 14 until that gets red to clear some heat. I would say that's more of the Chinese model rather than the Japanese version of Shoni Shin. Then I love silicone cups. They are fantastic for around the belly. Down the flanks, if a child has that classic wood invading earth, which is very common in children because their digestive system is weak until 7 or 8. I also like to use it on gallbladder 34 and the lower back, which is the large intestine reflex zone. I like to use the silicone cups on the upper back for cough. And diagnostically, that's amazing because you can see how much heat is in the lungs by doing that cupping. I had a kid just the other day who was awfully unwell with asthma. Her oxygen saturation was at 94%, which is warning bells. And when I did those cups on her upper back, they were scarlet red, like absolutely burning red. And then the next treatment, she came back and the cups were just pink. So I know I'd cleared most of the heat out of the lungs in that first treatment. So silicone cups all the way. And then the Pioneer Press Tacks, our takeaway acupuncture option, brilliant for children because their chi comes so much closer to the surface because they're this little bubble of chi that you know, you could stick at a meter from the body and it would probably still work. They're fantastic. Acupuncture, obviously. And then I do have a little, like I mentioned, that rake, just a little selection of different Shoni Shin tools depending on what I'm doing. And then moxibustion, of course. I love those stick-on moxes where you just peel them off and they stick and they burn down. We call those volcanoes and we watch the smoke dance. If they're going to touch it, I would never use those on a toddler. That's where I use. I actually bought an e-moxer. I don't know if you guys have tried it, but it's an electronic moxer pen, and it heats up in under 5 seconds. It's completely smokeless, and so often use that on the toddlers, on the ones that are going to try and grab the Moxa stick or, you know, put their hand in the Moxa box or something. But if I feel like I'm at risk of burning, I'll use the e-Moxa. And then obviously there's laser. I've never been in a consult where I've thought, God, I wish I had a laser. And so until I've had that feeling, I'm not going to fork out the $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 for one of those. I feel like I've got by this far without one. So, but other people, I mean, if I was starting out, I think it'd be brilliant.
I haven't tried the e-Moxa. I've seen it, but I wondered what's your observations in how it works in comparison to the other Moxa. Do you use the smoky or the smokeless stick-on Moxas?
I use lots of different Moxa. I use the stick-on, the skin, the tiny little ones. I use the thin Japanese Moxa that I get from Needle Pro. I've never liked the smokeless charcoal sticks. I didn't take to those. I love a Moxa box with nice Japanese Moxa punk. That's excellent. If the whole abdomen's cold or the whole lower back is cold, I'll Moxa box. And for kids, sometimes I'll need to use like two Moxa boxes, which is crazy. That just shows how much cold there is. But I'll always cup first, you know, to get that idea of, well, how deep is this cold sitting? I'll use those silicone cups to check how deep it is, and then if I feel like it's quite deep, I'll use the Moxa box. And then I have a lion and tiger warmers, so that's what I started with, but they just take a lot of time to get hot in my experience. I'm standing there fiddling around trying to get this incense stick lit that I'm breaking rapport with the child while I'm trying to deal with this bloody thing. And by the time the treatment's finished, that's when the stick is well alight and it's ready to go and it's like, you know, too late. So I think that's why I love the e-Moxa, is that it's hot and it's ready. And honestly, I'm getting just as good results. I was quite skeptical. You know, I'd like to say I'm more of a traditionalist, not pure, but more. But I think it's quite good. It's just so convenient too.
That's really good to know, because I find the therapeutic differences between the real Moxa and the smokeless Moxa inadequate for my liking, although I have found I've recently tried the stick-on smokeless Moxa and found that that actually works almost the same as the stick-on smoky one. So I'm like, oh, okay, this is good. But I was curious and skeptical about the e-Moxa. So it's good to hear from your perspective, because it sounds like you've tried lots of different things and that you're mainly interested in what works rather than just using the tool and hoping for the best.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think, you know, when you're working with children, it's very clear if your treatment has worked or not. You know, we've spoken a lot about when it works, it works quickly. And just on the other side of that, if what you've done isn't the right thing, it'll be just as obvious. So there's no room for the ifs, buts and maybes. It's either worked or it's not. I like that certainty in practice. I think I'm quite a metal element, and so it's like, you know, well, you're either going to do the thing or you're not going to do the thing, you know, straight down the line.
So that was the physical aspect of your practice. Tell us about the other part.
Ooh, we can talk psycho-emotional?
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, I encourage, once again, everyone to step into the world of pediatrics, because the trauma load is so much less. When I moved from the city down into the country, I took 7 months off as long service leave just to ground, restart. I'd been in practice for 15 years. And during that time, the load and the size of the bag that I was carrying with everyone's stories, I had no idea I was holding. And so when I used to work in the psycho-emotional space, the gynecology and fertility, I remember coming home in an evening and being absolutely cooked. Don't talk to me. I'm just going to have a bath and go to bed. And that was after maybe 14 patients. Whereas a day with children, you know, oh, I've got a bit of a cough or I've got some constipation or my focus at school isn't amazing. And around all of that is play. I come home and I'm bouncing. I'm still talk to me. I can be a lovely mother. It's a much lighter space to work in. Other than those, like we spoke about before, Jack, those difficult cases, they're the ones, but they're much fewer and they're much less intense. You know, in that case I spoke about before, that wasn't any kind of traumatic environment for the child or things happening to them. That was the conditions we were dealing with were chronic conditions. So it's a joy. It's ever changing. You know, if we think about treating adults, you know, you might get a 20-year-old versus a 40 to 50-year-old perimenopausal, menopausal woman, and then geriatrics. But if you compare that to an infant, to a toddler, to a prepubescent or a teen, you know, that's that scope of practice is massive. So that to just do pediatrics, I think, gives you all flavors of working with different people and different conditions and working in different ways. I had a set of twins recently, maybe 12, coming in for wellness because the parent was wellness-minded. And those two would have a competition of, well, how many needles are you going to have today? Well, I'm going to have 11. If you're going to have 10, I'm going to have an 11. So, you know, the environment can be so fun and so light. I would say light and warm-hearted is the main words that come to me when working with children and families.
That actually sounds pretty great, to be honest, even as a relatively fresh prac. I'm curious then where, if someone, and I'm sure there'll be many, many people listening to this episode who are very curious about pediatrics as a result, but are not necessarily sure where to begin, what's your advice for the first, taking their first steps into the world of Chinese medicine pediatrics?
Good question. Well, that's hopefully where I'm going to step in. Later this year or early next year, I plan to run seminar series on pediatrics, where to begin. And that's like what you mentioned at the start of this presentation around doing the one-hour workshop at ACMAC in August this year. And then in Perth on the 25th of October, I'll also be running another workshop, just a shorter workshop on pediatrics for AACMA. But I think getting some non-needle tools would be somewhere to start. So like I mentioned, some Moxa, the silicone cups. I mean, you can even use a tiny dessert fork as your, if you feel an area that's trapped with heat, or if you feel swollen glands on the neck, you simply need to bring blood flow to the area and that will get you started. And if you're not confident enough to treat kids that are paying for your services, find your friends or make some friends that have kids that, you know, can I practice on you? and or observe someone who does treat children. And my doors are always open if anyone's in the great southern WA in Denmark. Anyone is welcome to come and observe me in practice. And then, yeah, go and do a seminar and just begin. Start The books, I think the most recent book that Rebecca Avon has put out, which is around practical pediatrics, is excellent. I only just got it in the mail and I haven't put it down. And like I said, I'm not the best reader, but she just puts it in such a clear, concise way of what are the soft furnishings that you need when working with children? And that's attunement and rapport and fun and looking and listening to the nonverbal cues. And I'll talk on consent, if you don't mind, around children and that, because for a child who is yet to speak, you need to find a way, or you need to be able to see what's their yes and what's their no. And so I encourage all practitioners to first demonstrate what it is they would like to do on a child on themselves first. So my warm-up for most children, especially young children, is the Shoni Shin pattern of all routines, say. And so during that, it's light touch. It's very relaxing. They're getting the message that this person is safe, this person is gentle, and they're caring for me. And as a practitioner, it's giving me all the clues of, well, where am I going to take my next part of treatment? Where are they stuck? Where are they hot? Where are they cold? This is giving me time to map out my treatment principle, to make that really clear, to hone in the next bit, because the next bit might not feel quite as good as the Shoni Shin. So I'm going to have to make sure I need as little as possible and to do it as well as possible. So for a nonverbal child, once I've shown them on my arm, you know, this is the Shoni Shin light stroking, and then we do some bouncing buttons. And then I'll say, oh, you know, I have some green trees on my trolley and they look like this. And so I'll get a very small 15 mil serum needle, and I'll often use large intestine 4 because I'm often using that point. Try and use the point that you are going to do on them. So often children will walk in and I've got needles all over my head still because I've shown the previous patient, or I'm just trying to desensitize this understanding of needles. So they're, you know, seeing it and going, oh, wow, you know, they want to touch it. And so I'll show them the large intestine 4 and I'll say, can you help me and hold my soft, fluffy white cloud? So they're holding the fluffy white cloud, and then I've put the acupuncture needle in and I'm watching really closely for their response, because some are leaping back off the table and I'm like, this is off the cards for a long time. These are usually the kidney deficient kids, or the kids that lean in and they're like, that's amazing. And so I'll say to them, do you want to take it out? And this is the excess kid, right? This is the kid I'm actually wanting to do acupuncture on. So they'll pull out my needle and I, you know, give them the tray to pop it in or whatever. And then I'm rubbing my spot with the fluffy cloud and I'm like, so, you know, do you want a green tree? And some will nod. That's my nonverbal yes. Or their eyes will just go big and they're in a little freeze. And I'm like, okay, no, absolutely, we're not doing that. I've got this other thing that's going to work way better for you today. We're going to do some tapping. And so I'll get a little tapping tool. I can get the back end of a spoon. It doesn't matter. Something to stimulate and tap this acupuncture point until I get a reactive response on that point. So, yeah, consent, nonverbal, verbal, it's really important. And I think if we show the child what's going to happen on us first, that is pure consent. Because you can't say to a kid, hey, I just want to use this single-use sterile needle and place it on large intestine 4 to clear some heat from your head. Like, okay, you know, they don't know what they're agreeing to. So when I show on me, from their body language, from their eyes, I know if I've got consent or not.
And how often do you see that there might be a yes from the child, but then the parent is potentially the one who is cautious or is not giving their yes?
Great question. this is, this is an important one. If I've got the yes from this, you know, excessive robust kid that's like deep in there, just want to, you know, get in the mosh pit, I always look up at the child and just say, consent, mum? And they either say yes or no. It, once again, I think it comes down to that constitutional state of the person. If I've got a very depleted, kidney deficient mother, for example, who's cooked, they haven't slept in weeks, their nervous system is shattered, but their kid can tolerate this and they feel that I have a good connection with their child, it's always a yes. I think it's only ever been a no for me if I've had a very small child with a new parent who is highly anxious. Then they will be like, oh, and it's off the table then for me. It's absolutely not worth pushing it. It's never worth pushing it with the child or the parent because you want to be able to see them again. And that can be done on the second appointment. And often you don't need to because whatever light therapy you've picked instead has worked in the meantime.
And how often are you needing to use herbs or how often do you use herbs in your clinic or are you more focusing on acupuncture and nutrition strategies?
I love herbs. I absolutely love herbs. And I have to thank the late Alex Tabiri for his passion for herbs around pediatrics. I bought and listened to every single one of his Pacific Symposium lectures on herbs for children because, once again, that was out of fear. It was like, how do I give children herbs? Like, am I going to blow up their digestive system? You know, everyone's like, be very careful with their delicate digestive system. And the more I've done it, I don't think you need to be as cautious as we're kind of told to be. Sure, lessen the dose for particularly young children, but educate the parents. That's the biggest block for herbs in my experience is my kid doesn't like the taste. Yeah, so what? Like, if they're being given antibiotics or pain medication from the doctor, you're holding your kid down to give it to them most of the time, right? But then with herbs, all of a sudden they're like, well, they don't like the taste. And so that's just a little, and I don't recommend holding down children and giving them their medicine, but it's just empowering the parent to say, Johnny, this is medicine and we're going to take this medicine. And I can stand in the kitchen all day with you until you want to take your medicine. We're going to get this thing done. And I think if we're talking about the modern child and family dynamics, I think it's important to have a captain of the ship. And that's the parent. And so to answer the second part of your question there, Claire, I think with digestive system issues, absolutely love Xiao Jianzhong Tang or Lu Junzi Tang, Bu Chong Ichi Tang, Shenling Baiju San, or cough, asthma, Jersol San, Ding Chuan Tang, Bu Fei Tang. And then when we're getting a bit older into period-related disorders, I'm treating them as an adult woman in terms of Tao Hong Su Tang or whatever it is they need in order to move blood and stop pain if that's the main complaint. The thing I won't use, I've forgotten my favourite, Xiao Chai Hu Tang, of course, for the lingering pathogen. That is an absolute must. And for glue ear, I'm adding things like Yuan Zhe or She Chang Pu to target the ear with that lingering pathogen formula, where I'm tweaking it in other ways to affect the digestion or so on. So I'm using herbs a lot more. In the past probably 2 years, I'm just going for it. And the results are better if the parent can administer it.
What form do you give them in? Do you prescribe them as raw herbs that the parent boils up and doses out however you prescribe? Or do you give black pearls? Do you make your own pills? What kind of form are we talking of herbs here?
So before, when I mentioned I lean more towards the traditionalist aspects, but I do sit in the middle, I have a full granulated herbal extract dispensary and some honey pearls. So I actually stopped prescribing herbs for probably 2 years, just went, nah, what's in these herbs? I'm eating organic. Am I potentially toxifying myself on these herbicides and pesticides in these herbs? So then, excellently, Divine Timing, Empirical Health came out with Simon Feeney, and I had confidence in the herbs I was prescribing. So for young children, Jack, I get the parents to dissolve up the granulated herbs in the boiling water, suck it up with a little syringe, because most children have had some Panadol or Nurofen in their life, and so they're used to having something gently squirted in their mouth to administer. Older children, I'm getting them to do the little espresso quick thing, and I will show them how to do that in clinic, and I'll tell the kid, you know, if you block your nose, it's amazing. You can't taste anything. Like when you've got a cold, you know, when you're all snotty, you can't taste the ice cream. How disappointing. But if you don't want to taste these herbs, what happens if you block your nose? And then I'll say, and maybe you can have a sweet treat after. Maybe mum can get you some dried apricots or a special date. Some parents will use lollies. I will offer the healthiest solutions. Some parents will go for the Smartie or the jelly bean or whatever. And honestly, I don't think that matters. I think that's absolutely okay, as long as it's not a whole bag of lollies every time. And they can add honey if they want. It just has to get done, doesn't it? And I have a case recently of a child who has been in and out of hospital for the past 3 years. In hospital every week to every fortnight with breathing distress and pretty intense breathing distress. And since seeing me, we haven't had another hospital visit, which is amazing. But I'm petrified. If I go on holiday and I'm not here for that week, I'm thinking, oh, God, how's this patient going to go? So I've given her herbal medicine, and the mother decided it's not worth the battle. And in this particular case, I'm on her side there. This child is particularly strong. So she said, I said, as long as you're happy to come as often as it takes to get the results we're after for your child, it will mean I need to see her physically more often versus if you have the herbal medicine at home, we can start stretching out the treatment. She said, no, I'll drive an hour to you every week if I don't have to have that battle with my kid over herbs. So that's what we're doing.
That's so interesting, isn't it? The uniqueness of their personalities, and you know, some kids are so engaged in their own healing process, and they're so on board, and they sometimes almost volunteer to take the herbs, even if the parent's cautious. But then, you know, mm-hmm. in this example, it's the other way around, despite the level of distress that comes with the symptoms.
Exactly.
And I'm kind of curious to know, Holly, I've had this question that's been slowly building in the back of my mind since we started talking, and really since we, I think probably percolating since you first reached out and we started to organize the episode. Because treating children is quite different from treating adults. And as we've discussed, as we grow older, we become these kind of tangled balls of wool of all of the things that we don't quite get resolved or that we pick up along the way and those kinds of things. And it's often like a lot simpler when you're treating children in a lot of ways, or a bit more straightforward at the very least. And so I'm curious, after your time treating pediatrics so in such a focused way, what have kids taught you about healing that we often forget as adults?
Wow, that's a great question. You floored me on that one, and I love it. We ask that second bit again. What has treating children taught me about healing?
That we often forget as adults.
I think if we get out of the way and allow our truest self-expression, the chi flows. So if you're given permission while growing up to be your true authentic self, and that natural expression of the elements that come through you are approved or validated or accepted, I can't see how the chi would not. I think it would be free-flowing most of the time. I feel like the wei chi would be more defensive. Our assimilation through our digestive system for qi and blood production would be more effective and efficient. That would be remarkable. Imagine that. Amazing.
That's very cool to think about. And it's a great answer. A really, really good answer.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today, Holly. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you for the last hour and a bit and hearing all about the world of pediatrics. And it's definitely sparked my interest again in revisiting this world. It's a world where I think, you know, if more practitioners got involved and if more practitioners had the skills and the experience and even just the processes to be able to manage treatment of children in their clinic, we could make such a greater impact on the world.
Yes, exactly. And when you look at the run sheet of workshops and weekends on offer, you know, tell me the last time you saw a pediatric one on offer. And that's my mission of, well, why not? This is where it all starts. This is the most transformative, life-changing, setup for life bit. And I think we should, for those of us who can and are keen to, go for it.
Well, we will link to your upcoming courses on our show notes page. And for those who want to find out more about Holly's courses, you can find the links to that on our website.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on, Holly. And thank you, everyone, for listening and tuning in. Please remember to rate our episode. It helps us reach other people and share this beautiful conversation and all of the others that we've had over the last couple of years with other practitioners so that they can learn and we can share as a community. Thanks, and bye for now.
Bye for now.